It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up in Wisconsin Life, we'll talk about wheelchair athletics and efforts to provide adaptive fitness opportunities in Wisconsin to people with special physical needs.
First, nearly 15,000 people in Wisconsin have lost access to food stamps in the last 3 months, which could have a major effect on the state's food banks.
The current state budget created a law that able-bodied adults without children must be working or looking for work in order to receive food share benefits.
State lawmakers have said that this is evidence that the law is working. About 4,500 people found work through a job training program for food share recipients.
However, the news comes at a time when a number of food pantries around the state are bracing for a busy holiday season and ratcheting up their food drive efforts.
Joining us now is Sherry Tussler, Executive Director for the Milwaukee-based Hunger Task Force. Sherry, thanks for joining us today.
Glad to be here.
So you've said that the loss of food stamps for so many people will, quote, bankrupt our food banks. What do you mean by that?
What I mean is that the Hunger Task Force provides an effective guarantee to 54 food pantries, 20 soup kitchens, and homeless shelters here in Milwaukee County. And that guarantee can no longer be provided because we will be at risk of running out of food.
So you have asked the Department of Health Services and other lawmakers to waive a part of the law for people in Milwaukee due to high unemployment in that area. What would that have done specifically?
That would reverse the time-limited benefits. The waiver would allow people on food stamps to have food stamp benefits for a period of longer than 90 days in any three-year period. Right now, if you get the food stamps, you either participate or don't participate in employment and training programs. If you do not and you can't prove that you did work at least 80 hours a month, they close your food stamp case for 3 years.
And in response to your request, what did you hear from people who would be in a position to make those changes?
We heard from the Department of Health Services that they would not be looking at a waiver, that they felt that the program was successful. Their evidence was 3,900 people had found employment. Our concern, of course, is that 15,000 people did not find employment.
So what is the relationship between high or low unemployment and food stamps?
When there's a high level of unemployment, people are more likely to be eligible for food stamps. When people work part-time jobs or low-wage jobs, they are still eligible for food stamps. And when we have high levels of unemployment, people cannot find jobs. There should be a waiver in place from the federal government on work requirements.
And what kind of amount are we talking about when people get food stamp benefits? How much money are they getting to spend on food and other critical items?
Single adults get as little as $15 or $16 a month. The average benefit here in Milwaukee County is about $120.
So what have you been hearing or seeing about more stress on food banks that are associated with you or around the state since this law went into effect in April? So we're looking at, you know, about 7 months of history now.
Well, the law went into effect in April. The first case closures began in July because of the 90-day window, and each month since then, anywhere between 2,500 and 3,000 people have been cut off of their food share benefits here in Milwaukee County. As those numbers increase, demand for emergency food has also increased. We still have sufficient supplies of food on hand, but we are concerned that as the numbers will continue to increase, that we may lose our footing and we may not be able to provide food to everybody who's going to be in need.
We're talking with Sherry Tussler, who is Executive Director for the Milwaukee-based Hunger Task Force. We're talking about the 15,000 people who have been moved off of the food stamp program because of Wisconsin legislation that went into effect in April. Now, Sherry, State Representative Mark Bourne has said that the changes to food share are working as intended because about 4,500 people have found work through a new program for training recipients of food stamps. Do you think that's a fair assessment of the changes to the law?
No, I don't. I think that if we invested $100 million in our state in a job training program that only employed 4,900 people, that we have not gotten a very good bargain for our tax dollar.
So what would you say would be a better approach? Because often we do hear people want the opportunity to work. They want to have that feeling of self-sufficiency. So what needs to be in place to allow people to move off of food stamps because they can provide for themselves?
Well, I think the job training program should include actual job training as opposed to just referrals for jobs that may or may not be open in the community. Right now, our local company is a for-profit company. You go in for an orientation. They give you some job leads on paper, and they tell you to go get a job. That's not job placement, and that's not job training. So I think for our investment, we should get actual job placement and actual job training.
This is a time of year where it's very common to see bins for food donations and food drives. They're certainly around other parts of the year, but there seems to be a real focus on the holiday season. Why is it now that there's such a need for food banks and for providing for those food banks?
You're right. People like to give seasonally at the holiday, and they want to give holiday foods. It makes everybody feel better to know that somebody's sitting down and enjoying a nice holiday meal just as they are. It's a time when food pantries and food banks are sort of higher profile, and we're more aware of them, but the need is year-round. Here in Milwaukee County, more than 35,000 people visit a food pantry every month.
And I'm assuming that that would be comparable around the state. It's certainly not just in the large urban areas.
Right. Hunger is a problem in rural areas throughout the state of Wisconsin as well. The challenges are actually uniquely similar in that there are high levels of unemployment, there are large distances to travel to get the jobs, and the jobs don't pay a wage that would keep people from needing government assistance.
I'm guessing that families who are eligible for reduced or no-cost lunches, for instance, for children, are also probably, there's a lot of overlap with people who are getting food benefits. So are there other times of the year where families are especially pressed to provide healthy food for their families?
During the summer months, a lot of families will struggle because school does provide breakfast and lunch, and in some cases even a supper in a daycare setting. And when those programs close and school recesses in June, we see hunger increase for children June, July, and August.
So you said that it is natural for people to want to give at this time of year. So I'm guessing that the donations that you and other food bank programs are getting around the holidays don't just carry you through the holidays, but through other parts of the year as well. How is the Hunger Task Force looking so far heading into this holiday season?
So far, so good. We made sure that a lot of families had turkey on the table this last Thanksgiving. We're turning towards hams beginning tomorrow. We're trying to make sure that people do get those holiday foods, but we also want to remind them that that demand is really high and not everybody's going to get their needs met.
And are you hearing similar reports from colleagues around the state?
Yes, we're hearing that some of the pantries in rural areas are going to have some even greater struggles than we will here in Milwaukee.
So for people who want to help in their own communities, which is totally understandable, but aren't sure where to go to do that or what's needed, I think that's often a question people have. What's the best way for people to connect with food banks or food programs in their own communities?
Well, they can check out 211. That's a simple information referral system. Here in Milwaukee, we've got an agency that operates it with a searchable database. But you can look for your local food pantry and help them out by either donating food or money to help them to operate. Most food pantries are faith-based, and so they can look to their congregation or church community and make a gift to a local food pantry. The gift of food is obviously always appreciated, but there are times when the pantries also need to pay their utility bills, and so a gift of cash doesn't hurt either.
And does the Hunger Task Force have any events coming up in the next few weeks to help deal with this higher demand you're seeing?
The Canadian Pacific holiday train is rolling into town on Friday, so people can come on down and make a food donation and visit with Santa Claus. We do have food for families going on right now here in the Milwaukee sort of metro area, so people can donate to a food for families bin at their store or in their workplace.
Well, Sherry, thanks so much for joining us today.
We appreciate the time.
That was Sherry Tussler, Executive Director of Milwaukee-based Hunger Task Force, discussing how recent changes in the Food Share Benefits Program will affect state food banks this holiday season.
After a car accident put him in a wheelchair at age 8, Jeremy Opie Lottie discovered adaptive sports at a camp held at the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. That experience launched Lottie's career as a Paralympian and as head coach and athletic director for wheelchair athletics at UW-Whitewater.
My name is Jeremy Lottie, but everyone calls me Opie. When I was a young kid, I looked like Opie from the Andy Griffith Show, and the nickname has stuck. Actually, I have to put it on my business card, too. Most people don't know my real name is Jeremy. I grew up in a small town, Okana, Wisconsin, north of Green Bay, right in the heart of Packer country, and absolutely loved it. I grew up in a town where, you know, when we got in our car accident, I was the only person in the town that had a disability. We kind of had to go through all that whole fight. Well, it's kind of funny, too, because I couldn't get into my school and I couldn't get into the library, and I was like 9 years old, so I was just like, ah, that's okay by me. But my mom did not think it was okay that I couldn't get into the school or library, so it was a pretty quick fight. She took care of business. The camp started, the first year was in 1993, and that's the first year that I attended camp. And it basically was founded because the people on campus knew that there was kids out there that didn't know adaptive athletics was such a thing. So the people on campus started a camp for the people around Wisconsin to come to UW-Whitewater and find out about playing tennis when you have a disability, about playing basketball, about playing football, and not only playing those sports, but being able to interact with other people that have a similar situation with having a physical disability. The camp has graduated to being just a basketball camp, and at our peak, I think we've had 110 kids, and on average we usually get 70 or 80 kids, and that's from across the country and even across the globe. Since 93, every single year that the camp has happened, I have attended it, whether it be as a camper or a counselor when I went to school here, and kept counseling until eventually I took over as wheelchair athletics, and now I'm the camp director. You know, I always had a passion for sports even before I was in a car accident and ended up in a wheelchair. And what wheelchair basketball camp and sports camp did for me was it showed me that my passion for sports didn't have to change because my ability changed. I had to find a new way to be able to do the things that I was passionate about. I play every day. I work out every day. I absolutely love the sport. I'm sitting in my everyday chair right now, and my everyday chair is it's very skinny. And it's designed to be able to get through doorways. If I gotta go shopping, it's designed to cruise around my house. I can get through grass. I can go up and down curbs. It gets me through everyday life. I can get it in and out of my car really easily. The chair that I play in for basketball, it wouldn't fit through any doorways. It's got real wide angle. It's got some extra wheels on the back. I actually use a couple of seat belts to strap myself in. So when I fall on the ground, which happens when you're playing wheelchair basketball, I can actually just use my arms to pop right back up. And it is 100% designed, custom fit for me, and anyone that's playing wheelchair basketball pretty much has a chair that is designed for their body type. When people come out and see the sport for the very first time, I tell you what, the first 5 or 10 minutes, people are going to hear chairs banging, and they're going to see people falling over, and they're going to see the wheelchairs. And then after you start to enjoy it, and you're just like, holy cow, these guys are out here competing, this is a sport, and then you stop seeing the wheelchairs. I always like to remind people that we live an everyday life just like everyone else does. You know, I have a regular vehicle and I have a regular house, and when I'm done with my job coaching wheelchair basketball, I go home to my wife and we hang out, and, you know, we all live a pretty normal life. This wheelchair is what I use to get around, but it doesn't change who I am as a person.
Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. It's a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more online at wisconsinlife.org.
And you don't need to be a Paralympian to participate in adaptive athletics here in Wisconsin. Joining us now to talk about adaptive recreation opportunities is Chad Tom. He's Adaptive Sports Supervisor for Madison School and Community Recreation. Chad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for inviting us.
Well, before we get into the programs you offer there, I think a lot of people might assume that someone in that situation that we just heard about with OPI, somebody who finds themselves in a wheelchair or having other physical needs, their families might think, that's it. Athletics, recreation is done. But more and more, it sounds like that's not true. There's a lot out there.
No, there is. And actually, statewide, I know the Wisconsin Interscholastic Athletic Association, WIAA, which organizes high school sports, has integrated some youth with disabilities into sports, track and field, swimming, and in other sports. And so they would be one contact for statewide sports.
Now, in Madison, with MSCR, where you work, tell us about some of the adaptive recreation and fitness programs that are going on there.
Yeah, we do a variety of things for different ages, youth and adults, and across types of disabilities. So it's we welcome anybody. We have some types of classes that draw more cognitive disabilities versus physical disabilities, but and vice versa. There's different things that just, naturally and sometimes because they're targeted, like we have a power soccer program for youth and adults with disabilities, and they use their power wheelchairs to play the sport on a gym court and basically push or strike a larger soccer ball by just driving into it with their wheelchair. That's actually a national sport now. So that's for people that don't use a manual wheelchair, that they, people like with muscular dystrophy, or it could be a variety of different types of physical disabilities. So that's one thing. We do power soccer year-round. They play in a Midwest league. We play other teams from Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, and Illinois. So we play in a regular league, fall and winter. So
if somebody out there is listening and thinking, hey, this is me, I could participate in something like this, or a family member could, how do they assess what sport might be a good fit for their particular needs?
I think it usually just starts with their personal interest. I mean, nationally, there are all sorts of sports in camps like the one at OP described at Whitewater. Would be for basketball. There's other camps out there, so they would just have to search. Like if they like tennis, there are probably regional tennis camps, and there's other camps. Minneapolis and Chicago, I know, offer camps in swimming and track and field and other programs. So for people with physical disabilities, there are not as many opportunities in Madison for sports, but power soccer is one sport we do have, and we are trying to develop some other things. Like we're working on a grant right now to start wheelchair tennis and road racing. We're trying to purchase a chair that could be used for both, that has an adaptation on the front that could be taken off so that it could be used for tennis, and then the adaptation is used for road racing. So the chair would actually be used for two different sports. If we get that would happen this spring and summer. So we are working on some new activities. We do have some just general fitness programs too, is probably what we're strongest in. We have a fit club for on Fridays and Saturdays for people just to come to a high school setting to do some weight training, some yoga, some free play basketball, swimming, and they just kind of decide what they want to do that day, and they can just work out, basically. So we're doing some programs like that, and have some other adapted things, like a chair exercise program for those folks that aren't as mobile, that just need, they exercise actually from their chair, doing stretching and leg and arm stretching and some small weight training and things that they can do from their wheelchair. So that's just someone that wouldn't be as mobile as Opie. And then we have a water walking program and a warm water pool, which is open to anybody, and it's good for just walking and for therapy and for just kind of general fitness and maintaining people's health and well-being. That's open three or four nights a week over at Lapham Pool. It's a small elementary school on the east side, and it's a heated pool, so that's a year-round program. So we have some things that would fit anybody, really.
Talking to Chad Tom, he is adaptive sports supervisor for Madison School and Community Recreation, about adaptive sports and fitness. Chad, do you sometimes have to, for the kids' programs particularly, do you sometimes have to work to calm down the parents, maybe feeling pretty protective, worried, especially in some of the sporting situations about injury? We heard from Opie about wheelchairs falling over, that sort of thing.
No, I don't see that as much anymore. I some years ago, I used to see that more. I think more and more people are comfortable with the fact that they want their kids to be active. So I mean, there is some of that, but I don't see a lot of it. We do have a downhill skiing program, which has all the adapted equipment. We ski at Tyro. So if people want to ski this year, they should give us a call. But we have the adapted sleds and bi-skis for people that have to sit down to ski. And we have trained staff and volunteers for that program. So we have all the adapted equipment for downhill skiing if people would like to try that.
How important are programs like this in the Madison community and elsewhere in the state, providing these adaptive sports and fitness programs?
Well, I think they're real important. The obesity level of people with disabilities is a little higher in general than the average population. So there is more prevention needed. People just need to stay active, find something that they like, and find an avenue for it, whether if it's on their own or in a community recreation department like MSCR here in Madison. There are YMCAs and neighborhood centers, and then, you know, some regional camps like the University of Whitewater. There's a lot of different regional camps people can go and try out a sport. So they should just kind of look around and find something that they might enjoy or they think they might enjoy and just try it out.
Chad, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, no problem, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
We've been talking to Chad Tom. He's the adaptive sports supervisor for Madison School and Community Recreation. We've been talking about adaptive fitness and sports here in Wisconsin.
A few years ago at the Wisconsin Film Festival, a documentary called The Linguists was shown. It followed two linguists as they rushed around the world to record some of the last native speakers of languages that were close to dying out.
Estimates are that 7,000 languages are currently spoken in the world. Our guest predicts that between 50 to 90% of languages around the world will be lost by the end of the 21st century. Many of those will be indigenous languages. As we close out Native American Heritage Month, we thought we'd focus in on one effort to preserve an indigenous language here in Wisconsin.
A current project centering on saving the Menominee language just received a grant to further efforts to take older Menominee materials and update them with modern spellings and more current English translations. Joining us to discuss this undertaking is Monica McCauley. She's a linguistics professor at UW-Madison and is working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the Menominee language.
Well, Menominee is an Algonquian language, and it's related to other languages spoken in the state of Wisconsin, Potawatomi and Ojibwe. It's very highly endangered. There's a very, very small number of native speakers, elder native speakers, that is, first language speakers, but they have an extremely strong language revitalization program going and a lot of very active second language learners.
So how long has Menominee been spoken in Wisconsin?
The Menominee are one of the few tribes that are still in their original location, their pre-contact location, pretty much. So certainly pre-contact.
And is it spoken anywhere else other than in Wisconsin?
No, it's not.
So this is really a rare language and very, very highly localized.
Yes, definitely.
Well, let's listen to a few phrases.
Poso.
That recording was part of materials made available through the Menominee Tribe of Wisconsin's language classes. We heard the speaker say, hello, how are you? I'm fine. And you said the Menominee is related to other native languages in the Great Lakes region. Is it related to any languages further afield than that?
Oh, yeah. The Algonquian family is a very, very large family. Stretches from the East Coast, not quite to the West Coast, but you do get Cree and Ojibwe and Cheyenne out west.
Now you said it's very endangered. How many remaining elders are original native speakers of Menominee?
Well, that's a very hard question to answer. I know of one who's still working with me. She's 89 years old, but still as spunky as ever. There are probably some others in the community that I don't know of and who are not interested in working either with me or with the language program, but okay. There's only one that I know of right now.
And were the Menominee one of the native tribes for whom their language was really discouraged by the settlers and by the dominant white culture around them?
Yeah. I don't think there were any that escaped that.
Mm-hmm. So you're working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language. It seems overwhelming. Where do you even start when a language is identified as being endangered? First of all, what are those kind of qualifications to be considered an endangered language?
The key thing is when children are no longer learning it. If it's not being transmitted across the generations, then that means the language is in trouble. And I mean, there are some languages, some native languages, where, you know, maybe they still have speakers in their 30s and 40s, but all that means is that the endangerment is not as severe, because it's, if the kids are not learning it, then it's not going to be continued.
So you identify that a language is endangered, and then what's the next step? Is it finding those remaining native speakers?
Well, that can be one of the steps. I think the really critical thing here is that it's not something that a linguist can do. Linguists can be allies in the fight to preserve and revitalize languages, but we're not the ones who do it. The community has to be, it has to come from within the community. And really, over the last, I don't know how many, couple of decades, huge communities of activists have sprung up, and it's really a strong movement right now. And in many cases, linguists are there helping. But we are certainly not the ones who can motivate it or make it happen.
So that goes along with the fact that you are working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission on this project. Who makes up that Language and Culture Commission within the tribe?
It's appointed by the tribal legislature, and it consists of elders and second language speakers and language teachers, I believe.
And so the commission is identifying this as, well, the tribe is identifying this as a priority and forming the commission, and then you or a linguist like you comes in. What role do you specifically play, and how can you be that support and ally for their efforts?
The kind of things that I can provide generally have to do with the grammar of the language and with documenting the language. So, for example, with the Menominee, they had a dictionary which was published in the 1970s, but actually compiled in up to the 1940s. So it was published quite a bit after the person who put it together passed away. But it was not very usable because it wasn't using their spelling system, and it only went from Menominee to English. There was no English to Menominee. So there are a lot of problems with it. So one of the projects that I undertook was to create a modern dictionary. And so together we've made two dictionaries, actually. One is a beginner's dictionary, sort of very simple with pictures, and it's organized by topic. And then the second one is, we call it the intermediate dictionary, and it's more of a traditional bilingual dictionary.
Well, in languages, modern languages, languages that are in common usage, are constantly evolving. So was one of the challenges that the Menominee to English dictionary that existed, had the English gotten kind of archaic or out of date?
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that we had to do is we had to sort of find more colloquial translations for a lot of the words. And then this is not exactly what you were asking, but I'm having a lot of fun right now, because one of the things that the Menominee want to do is start an immersion school for the kids. And if you're going to do immersion teaching, you have to have all of the words for all of the things in the curriculum.
Right.
So what we've been doing is we've been working on coming up with words for new concepts. Well, actually, the goal is going to be to teach the whole curriculum in Menominee, if they can get there. It's a lofty goal, but it's what they want to do.
So let's go back. You said that you're working with an 89-year-old native speaker.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say working with her, what does that exactly mean? What do you do with her?
I go up there about once a month, and we have elicitation sessions. And for a long time, one of the things I've been doing is checking the words in that original dictionary with the elders that I've worked with, to find out if they know them, and then if they do, to get other forms of them. Especially the verbs are extremely complex, and it's really important to get the verb conjugated in a couple of different ways so that you can see the variation that you get in it. So that's why checking the words has been so important. They don't know all of the words in the original dictionary, because the language has changed so much, and a lot of the time it's just not a context that they would have been in to learn the word. I had a funny experience once where I was asking some words that had to do with fish, with fishing, and I knew that, that the person I was working with really liked to fish, and so I, and she, but she didn't know any of the words, and I was kind of surprised, and she said, "I fish in English."
So even someone who is a native speaker might not be using that language for everything.
Yeah, exactly. So even when she, I mean, in this particular case, she grew up speaking it, and that was all that was spoken in her home, but she got sent to a school where she was forced to speak English.
So they are teaching a new generation to speak Menominee. Do you have a sense of how many people are studying it right now?
Well, they're teaching it in all of the schools on the reservation. So all of those children are being taught the language. And then there are a number of sort of young adults who are very, very interested in learning it and have varying degrees of fluency.
So as anyone who has studied a language knows, if you don't have opportunities to actually use it and stay fresh, it can get rusty very, very quickly, kind of amazingly quickly, I would say. Mm-hmm. How is the tribe working to make the Menominee language part of everyday life?
There's a term that linguists are using these days that I just love, which is language activists. So the people who are language activists, they're the ones who are just really, really passionate about keeping this language going. They speak it to each other constantly, and they make a real effort, I think, to speak it when they're out in public and to get people used to hearing it again. Now, certainly, you know, they have some things, like in meetings, you know, when there's a motion, instead of saying aye or nay in English, they say the appropriate things in Menominee. But in terms of conversation, it's really the ones who are the most advanced bilinguals, I think, who are still using it on a daily basis.
So as we mentioned earlier, it's the last day of Native American Heritage Month. As a linguist, why do you think that language is such an important part of culture and of identity?
There are a number of ways you can approach that question. For a lot of the Native Americans that I've talked to, there's a real sense that their cultural practices are phrased in the language, and a lot of religious matters are phrased in the language. Prayers are in the language. And so a lot of people will say to you something like, well, our language is sacred, which to someone coming from, you know, a Western scholarly academic point of view, doesn't make a lot of sense. I mean, I don't identify with that feeling at all. But that's a very strong feeling for people, Native Americans that I've met. And it's just intricately tied up. So another example might be that a lot of Native peoples, if they come from smaller groups, often, you know, they're just localized geographically, and so they're going to know, they're going to have names in their language for everything in their location. They're going to have names for plants and animals and you know, phenomena, which we may not actually even have words for in Western science. So I think the language is often very connected to life and land and religion. It's just integrated into every aspect of life.
Monica, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Sure. My pleasure.
That was Monica McCauley, a linguistics professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. She's working with the Menominee Language and Culture Commission to preserve the Menominee language.
On this last day of Native American Heritage Month, we want to share an interview by Central Time host Veronica Rickert. She spoke with Native American photographer Matika Wilbur about Project 562. That's her effort to take pictures of members of all 562 Native American tribes to combat what she sees as misrepresentation of them in the media.
Well, how did the Project 562 first come into being? Where did it come from?
Well, you know, I've been a photographer for the last 10 years, maybe 11 now, and I began to realize that there really wasn't an accurate representation of contemporary Native America in massive media, both through the lecturing that I was doing about my previous exhibits, We Are One People and We Emerge, and also just by Google searching. If you type in African American or Asian American, you'll find young, contemporary, or regular folks. If you type Native American, most times what you'll find is an image from the early 1900s. And so my goal really is is about creating a positive Indigenous role model and new image from this century that represents who we are today.
And I read that there was also a dream that came into play.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to the Rocky Mountain School of Photography and Brooks Institute of Photography in Santa Barbara in California. Mm-hmm. And when I was done with school, I pursued advertising in Los Angeles. And I've been working in L.A. for about, 9 months after college. And it was a devastation, really, because I realized that I didn't want to be in advertising. And here I'd studied advertising. And so I took a job in South America, actually. And I went and traveled all through Ecuador and Peru and Bolivia and began photographing indigenous people in the Amazon and in several different places. And I guess I'd been working down there about 3 years when I had this dream with my grandmother. She said, "What are you doing photographing these Indians when you haven't even worked with your own? You know, go home." And I did. I went home to Swinomish, where I'm from, and began my first series called We Are One People, where I photographed elders of Coast Salish tribes. And I asked them questions related to identity and spirituality, love, war. Really, it began my own questioning, what does it mean to be a young Native woman in a contemporary society? How do I learn to balance my cultural traditions with Western value systems?
So you took the advice of your grandmother in the dream, and you talked about the goal of this project to photograph all of the Native tribes in the United States, 562 at this point, and counting, I guess. But you've got a bigger goal, too. You're talking about changing the way people see Native Americans. Why is right now a good time to do that, to put a real face on Native peoples in the United States?
Well, that's a really good question. Why is it necessary? You know, between 1990 and 2000, there were nearly 6,000 blockbuster released films. Only 12 included American Indians. Of those 12 films, 10 showed Indians as impoverished or beaten down by society. 10 is continually in conflict with white or as a noble savage and spiritual warrior. However, the image of the contemporary business person, the artist, the photographer, the teacher, the doctor, the young professional, those images were largely absent. What's interesting is how that image manifests itself into our psyche. You see, one of my mentors, Dr. Stephanie Freiberg, who's actually from my dad's tribe, from Tulalip, who's a professor from Stanford, did a study. She's a psychologist, and she went to all of these different tribal schools and public schools around the country, and she showed younger kids between ages of 8 and 14 images from different backgrounds. And she would ask them questions related to self-esteem. And then when she would show them an image of a young Native person or of the stereotypical Native person, the Pocahontas, dances with wolves, Twilight, the Redskins, you know, their self-esteem would go down by almost 60%. And when shown to the white counterpart, their self-esteem would be raised. And so what that tells me is that the image of the Native person is perpetuating this this negativity. And I just think it's time for that to stop, don't you?
I think your images are incredible, and they definitely changed my thinking. They're incredibly striking, and I wonder if you could talk about the ground rules. There's only a couple things you ask of your subjects. What are they?
Well, I ask quite a bit for my subjects. I ask them if I could stay with them.
Besides crashing on their couches, what do they need to be photographed by you?
I ask that they be photographed within their indigenous territory, which usually extends beyond the boundaries of our reservations because, you know, the history of the reservation system has changed quite a bit over the last 150 years. And so within their indigenous territory, and I ask people, which sometimes, you know, I break the rules, you know, like, for instance, Jessica Metcalf is Turtle Mountain Chippewa, but I photographed her on Odom land because that's where we met up. So sometimes I break my own rules. And I also ask them, I ask them where they would like to be photographed in a location that's important to them. And then, of course, there's a series of questions before I photograph them, getting to know them, really asking them questions related to stereotypes and identity.
I asked them to tell me some interesting details about their tribe, why they chose to live on the reservation, why they maybe chose to leave, how they chose their partner. We talk about blood quantum, we talk about sovereignty, self-governance, protecting natural resources. It's a very long interview process.
Hmm. I want to ask you about one of the photographs that you took of Caleb and Jerob Dunlap from the Lake Superior Chippewa. Now, that's our neck of the woods, and they are having a blast, I'm guessing, in Lake Superior. Can you tell us anything about that photo shoot?
Yeah, Caleb and Jared, they're wonderful. I just love them. And actually, that photograph was taken on the canoe journey out this year at the landing in Quileute. But we are making plans to come to your region, hopefully next spring after the snow melts.
We've got a little bit of time left, and I know you clocked about 60,000 miles on this trip. Can you tell us a couple of the stories that stayed with you from this?
Oh, wow. You know, I have to tell you that the most amazing part of my journey is that I've been really welcomed and taken care of on the road. You know, I think it's really easy for us when we're at home and we're working every day and we're trying to get food on the table and we get caught up in the hustle and we watch the news, and it's easy to be sort of hopeless about the state of humanity. And I just have to tell you that people have been so kind to me and really welcomed me. I don't know how else to say it. It's just been overwhelming. And the incredible support that I've gained through Kickstarter contributors and the media across the country. I think it's what's really inspiring for me has been people are supportive of seeing a change, and that really gives me hope. But you know, I mean, road stories. Oh gosh, you know, I mean, like traveling in to have a supai at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. That was a wild adventure, and you know, everything from land controversies and water controversies out with the Paiutes to going to Kachina ceremonies in the Southwest. And it's just been so incredible.
Matika, we'll leave it there. Thank you so much for coming on and talking about it today.
Oh, well, thank you for having me. I'm really very honored.
That was Veronica Rickard talking with Native American photographer Matika Wilbur about Project 562. It's her effort to take pictures of members of all 562 Native American tribes in an effort to combat what she says are media misrepresentations.